Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Fascanis, Vice President from the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us for today's discussion, which will be on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have with us today CFR Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies, Ray Takei. In addition to his role at CFR, Dr. Takei is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He's an expert on Iran, political reform in the Middle East, and Islamist movements and parties. Prior to coming to CFR, Dr. Takei was a senior advisor on Iran at the State Department. He's the author of two books on Iran, The Guardians of the Revolution, Iran's Approach to the World, and Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. He will be publishing a CFR policy innovation memorandum later this autumn on promoting human rights in Iran, so I hope you will be on the lookout for that. Ray, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could talk about what is happening in Iran today with the leadership and what's happening on the ground, as well as assess the current relationship between Iran and Syria, given all that's happening in the Syrian debate. So over to you.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks very much for having me. Well, it's been an interesting and somewhat an unpredictable time since the June election. To say the least, it was probably a surprise for most people that Iran has a president that sort of campaigned against the regime and against some of the policies and practices of the incumbent regime. That's not unusual in politics in the West, but it is somewhat unusual in a politics of what it remains fairly repressive and a closed society. One of the interesting things about the Rouhani presidency early on, beyond its sort of discussions about international diplomacy, is there is a beginning of a sort of a more honest conversation with the Iranian people on the nature of the economic problems. You know, the beginning of seemingly issuing of statistics that are reasonable in terms of their accuracy. 70% of the municipalities are bankrupt. 45% of residents of Tehran know someone who's unemployed. In that particular sense, that's a kind of an honest conversation, but obviously that honesty does not go to issues of politics and society and so forth. That has a danger of actually delegitimizing the system because it's selectively honest, and on issues of economic gravity, they may be irreversible. So in that sense, it's a precarious proposition for authoritarian state to begin to speak the truth but in a selective way. Either you lie all the time or you don't. So in that sense, I think they're moving in a direction which could further endanger the regime, both from challenges from the left and the right. In terms of the Syria debate, there's been a lot of discussions in the region. The Middle East is one of those regions that kind of persistently insist on dividing against itself. That's not unusual. Perhaps that's also the case in other continents or other sub-regions. In this particular case, these divisions are increasingly sectarian-based, at least in terms of the way the conflicts are playing themselves out. So for the Iranian regime, they have identified themselves as part of the frontier or force of resistance, resistance front that involves themselves, elements within Iraq, Hezbollah, obviously the Syrian regime, and they're on the other side are, conservative monarchies, Sunni states involving Saudi Arabia and others. This particular conflict, this particular Cold War, I think it's playing itself out in a number of places. It's playing itself out in the telling of the Saudis and the Gulf and Bahrain, which I think is rather overstated, but perhaps not untrue. It's certainly playing itself out in Iraq. It's playing itself out in Lebanon. And it is also most dramatically playing itself out in Syria. So Syria is the part of this multi-front conflict in this Cold War divided region that has gotten the most attention for reasons that are obvious. It's the place where the civil war is at its most emphatic, and it is a civil war that is beginning to invite international intervention and international mediation. So, but you have to think about Syria and situate it in a larger landscape of Iranian-Saudi hostility, which is underwritten by some sectarian issues, which means this particular division of the Middle East is likely to be more enduring because the basis of those divisions aren't secular ideologies, I have socialism, what have you, but actually more deeply rooted individual identities. There's an instrumentality to all this as well, to be sure, but that's how I think I see it. In that sense, you know, all parties involved in the Syrian affair are playing for keeps. The Syrians are, the Iranians are, the Saudis, and so they tend to be more focused and concentrated on one side or the other winning, as opposed to having some sort of a power-sharing arrangement that maybe international actors would want, the United States, perhaps Europe, and even perhaps for that matter the Russians. So in that sense, I think the Syrian civil war is a symptom of a larger division that has taken place in the region. To some extent, those divisions predated the Arab Spring. Obviously, they go back to Iraq War and even before that. And now you begin to see it's probably its most tragic crystallization in Syria itself.
Great. Thank you, Ray. Let's open up for questions from the group and comments, et cetera. Austin? Ray?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know where our operator is at.
Okay.
I'm right here. I apologize. I was down.
Okay. All right. So if you
yes,
please
ma'am.
Open up for questions. I've queued up. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in which the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, that was star 1.
Ray, while we're waiting for questions to queue up, do you
sure.
believe that President Rouhani is genuine in his commitments to provide greater nuclear transparency?
Yes, I think to an extent, right? Everything is up to a point. I suspect that the formula that sort of the Iranians are thinking of is a sort of size for transparency, whereby international community concedes to the nuclear program in all its dimensions and perhaps its further growth. And in exchange, the Iranian regime will agree to more transparency and coming to terms with the IAEA regarding past infractions. That's going to be difficult to do in of itself, because some of the things that the IAEA would want to know about is previous weaponization activities. It would want to interview scientists, have more unimpeded access to sites, be in possession of data. So to suggest transparency is not an easy task to achieve, because for a long time the Iranian regime has denied that it has engaged in previous nuclear weaponization activity and research. It has attributed those claims to and that evidence to fabrications. So coming clean would be to essentially reject previous Iranian explanations. Now, there's probably a couple of ways you can do that. But also, I don't think the international community will be satisfied with further transparency, because they would want, nowadays, different actors, but I suspect the French and maybe even the United States would want that for Iran to dismantle some key apparatus, ship out some of its accumulated fuel, essentially to make sure that the program is not on path for breakout capacity. So that's going to be difficult for the Iranians to agree, so the data points on that front are not adding up. But I do think Hassan Rouhani has made a commitment to revive the economy. And there used to be a time when strategic decisions and economic decisions were somewhat separate. Now they're not. You can't improve your economy unless there's a different approach to the nuclear issue, because the nuclear issue has resulted in imposition of fairly strenuous and internationally cohesive economic sanctions. Not entirely cohesive, but, you know, the loss of substantial revenues. So the nuclear issue is the economic issue, and the economic issue is the nuclear issue. And therefore, you can't resolve one without the other.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. We have several questions queued up now. Let's take them, Austin.
Our first question comes from Dwight Basher with U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Oh, hello, Ray. Thanks for your presentation. I had a couple of quick questions for you regarding your recent take on human rights in Iran, the op-ed you wrote. And, you know, I think with regard to Iran, you know, there was a lot of campaign promises that President Rouhani made regarding improving conditions in the country. One area, obviously, that I focus on is on the religious minorities. And we saw the killing of a Baha'i for the first time in about 15 years, where it was verified he was targeted for his religious belief. This is a community, and I want to get your take, that obviously doesn't pose a political threat, has never touched arms, et cetera, yet is the largest religious minority community. It seems to me that if you're talking about getting some congressional support for human rights, like you use that Helsinki model, there's a lot of people who are interested in accountability. How do you, weigh accountability for actions towards communities like the Baha'is or even Christians, the imprisonment of a pastor, an Iranian-American pastor, et cetera, who obviously have not committed any crimes but are targeted? How do you get a gauge on whether Rouhani, and your view, is he really committed to this kind of transformation in the country, or is this simply window dressing like we saw the reaching out to the Jewish community on Twitter and the foreign minister saying, wishing a happy Rosh Hashanah, that kind of, conciliatory language? Do you see any genuineness here, and is there going to be some kind of effort by his presidency to go up against the supreme leader to make progress in that area?
Sure. On the issues of domestic liberalization, which I think is what you're alluding to, and religious freedom to worship would fit into political liberalization. No, he has not. That's not his forte. That's not what it is. In the 1990s, when the reform movement began, they had a large considered discussion of liberalization, civil society, and those issues were considered in that particular context. Not this particular set of leaders. They're more interested in trying to relieve economic pressure and essentially rehabilitate the system, but not necessarily to reform the system along the lines that I think you're suggesting. The Iranian clerical estates opposition to the Baha'is, of course, as you know, quite long-standing. They tend to view them as distorting Islam and all kinds of issues of heresy and so forth. So the persecution of the Baha'i has been a long-standing and mainstay of the clerical community during the time of the monarchy, when there was tensions between church and state. That was one of the demands of the religious actors, that Shah should be more active in the prosecution and persecution, actually, of the Baha'i community, which actually gained some degree of prominence in both business community and government sectors under the Shah, and that was one of Islamic Revolution's indictment against the Shah, opening it up to those with heretical practices. Any sort of a human rights issue as going through Congress or along the models of Helsinki, because as you recall, Helsinki eventually, one of the benefits of the Helsinki watch groups that were established in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union itself was that actually pulled together the many unrelated human rights activists. For instance, in the Soviet Union, the Jewish refusenik, people like Sakharov, and also religious nationalists sort of came together and became a part of a more cohesive human rights unit with a more elaborate definition of what constitutes human rights. And I think if you look at U.S. Congress, it has established various commissions for religious liberties, and any discussion of human rights that includes, you know, essentially freedom from arbitrary government intervention, right? And that also would include issues of religious practice. It would be very difficult to do that in a context of theocracy that by constitution proscribes many other religious practices that are not recognized as the so-called people of the book. Obviously, that involves Muslims, it involves Christians, actually, and even acknowledgement of the Jewish faith, because these are all people of the book. Now, in practice, there's always discrimination and second-class citizenship, but there are entire religious practices that, therefore, are not even recognize or acknowledge as legitimate exercise and legitimate spiritual pursuits. And that would have to be included as in the definition of human rights in terms of that's part of the international norms, since that phrase seems to be quite popular nowadays. So I agree with you that the issues of religious freedom and conscience should be included in that as well. Yes.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Radhas Lam with the University of Hawaii.
Yes. Thank you, Ray. My question is actually about Jews in Iran, and very similar to the whole idea of religious freedom. But I'm just wondering, under the new president, under the new rule, if you perceive any kind of alteration in the way Jews in Iran are treated?
Well, to be fair to the Islamic Republic, it has always tried to differentiate between its opposition to what it would call the Zionist enterprise or Zionism as opposed to Jews. Now, it's a distinction that, as you can see, cannot always be maintained because the relationship between the two is kind of obvious. And it also, the opposition to Zionism, if you would, has gotten the United States, gotten Iran, the Islamic government, to engage in a denial of some basic historical verities, denial of the Holocaust, for instance, which I have to say is not limited and was not limited to President Ahmadinejad. Many people within the Islamic Republic, including the Supreme Leader, have always indulged in the notion that Holocaust was a fabricated historical event and so on. And so there's a strain of anti-Semitism, actually, that has always colored the important actors within the clerical community within the Islamic Republic itself. And you know, that's likely to be mitigated to an extent because one of the things that the Iranian regime has recognized is that this sort of a belligerent rhetoric and sort of that sort of incendiary rhetoric makes people lose confidence in a government that is pursuing a nuclear capability, right? So
yeah.
The way essentially you want to, so if you want to continue your nuclear capability, you really have to temper your rhetoric. And that might not be possible because there are many individuals within the Islamic Republic, within this broad spectrum of the Iranian Islamist elite, who can't help themselves from denying the legitimacy of key narratives within the history of the Jewish people. So that sort of a discipline that Rouhani wants to impose on systems rhetoric may actually not be possible, given the fact that there are many centers of power which, although not independent, are capable of independent action. And there are a lot of organizations that actually monitor this, because that's the advantage of technology, right? With so many things being on the web and so forth, you can always monitor the rhetoric. And the rhetoric is likely to be mitigated, but I don't think it will evaporate.
All right. Thank you very much.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Donald Rogers with Catholic Relief Services.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. My question is how the leadership is looking at the current instability in Syria and how concerned they are about the possibility that this could expand beyond borders and become a regional conflict. It seemed that actors to win versus having a situation in which there is a mediated peace. So I was just wondering if you could speak more about that, as you did address it briefly in your comments, but I wonder if you could expand upon that. Thank you very much.
Thanks. The Syria conflict has already seeped beyond its borders, where there's a heavy refugee crisis. I think now the number of Syrian refugees in Jordan constitute the fifth largest city in Jordan. And you begin to see them going to Turkey, and that actually stresses the economies, and certainly in Jordan's case, even the demographics of the state. And so it's already has had the spillover effect in that sense. There's always a fear that the Syrian civil war can be regionalized, you know, and you're already seeing some indications of that. The dispatch of Hezbollah from Lebanon, the dispatch of expeditionary forces from Iran. We have not seen, as far as I know, a comparable deployment of military forces by Saudis and others, but we have seen Islamist militants and activists from different parts of the Gulf and even Europe to make their way to this latest frontier of jihad. So there is some of the things that you're talking about have already taken place. The longer the civil war goes on, they're likely to be intensified as both sides try to figure out how to improve their tactics, sharpen their weaponry in order to win. And this is one of the dangers of civil war. It was the conflict in Iraq that many feared would have the same effect in terms of regionalization of the conflict. If you look at Lebanon, that collapsed in a similar confessional civil war. There was an agreement. There was even, you know, intervention of Syrian troops into Lebanon for many years. And ironically enough, that intervention was somewhat acknowledged by the Israelis because it essentially helped stabilize Lebanon. But there is a danger of that taking place. Some of it has already taken place. Now, whether this conflict can be mediated before this is exacerbated, I'm doubtful. But also, there is one aspect of the region, a region accustomed to this low-intensity conflicts, is there's always an element of self-restraint built into these actors. I suspect for the foreseeable future, they will all rely, the Saudis, Iranians, on proxies and try to limit their own direct intervention in some way that prolongs the civil war in Syria because they're not paying the cost in a direct manner. But the region has a capacity for exercising some degree of self-restraint as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Again, that was star one to ask a question. Our next question comes from Thomas Athut with Friends of United Nations Alliance of Civilizations.
Hi. Dr. Take, if I could pick your brain a bit on Iranian politics, given the dominance of the supreme leader over the Iranian political system, My first question is, how much will Rouhani be able to liberalize? Wouldn't he be circumscribed by Khamenei's discomfort on various issues? And the second question, because I haven't really seen much about this, and I've heard some rumors about Khamenei's health. Who are the potential successors to Khamenei? Do we know anything about potential successors, what they think like on both foreign and domestic issues? Thank you.
On terms of liberalization, unlike the 1990s, I don't think Hassan Rouhani is looking to liberalize Iranian politics. He may want to restrain some of the religious strictures and interventions by the religious police, which are bothering people, aggravating them. He may want to rein some of that in. But in terms of the whole enterprise of trying to reform the political system in a manner that makes it more accountable to the citizenry, that's not something, that's not part of his mission, right? That's never been part of his interest. Hassan Rouhani is basically a backroom bureaucrat who wants to rejuvenate the Iranian economy by hopefully having some sort of a successful diplomatic outreach that nonetheless allows them to maintain substantial nuclear infrastructure. Those are a lot of contradictions in there, but his mission has not been to strengthen civil society, reform the institutions in a manner that they become more accountable to the citizens, and essentially inject public opinion in deliberations of the state in a more inclusive way. So in that sense, Ali Khamenei doesn't have to worry about how to restrain his liberalizing tendencies, because those tendencies are rather modest. In terms of the Supreme Leader's health, I have heard over the years about health problems, but, you know, he seems to be going on. Occasionally, there are people who predict his death. Someday they'll be right. But so far, he has defied those. Succession to the office is going to be difficult. In the aftermath of the 2009, where there was some sort of a fracturing of the elite. Now the elite, to some extent, is coming together more. There are a number of ways the office can be succeeded. Some have suggested that perhaps, you know, one of the ideas that was around last time in 1989 when the first Supreme Leader died was to have a committee as opposed to a single Supreme Leader. Having lived under the dictatorial power of the Supreme Leader, that would be a way of ensuring it's a dilution of that office because, you know, again, three people would have to come together on an opinion. So he may not be succeeded by a single individual, but perhaps by a committee of three. That was one of the ideas that was mooted, and therefore all political tendencies will have a representation in that office. Sometimes it is suggested that, no, it'll be one person again, and who that person is unclear at this point because its successor is not obvious. There is a constitutional process that they would have to go through, and the assembly of experts, elderly clerical body that meets once or twice a year, would be empowered to choose a successor. However, I think when time comes, other institutions of the state will also have a say. I think the security services, the Revolutionary Guards, and others would have to be part of the conversation about who becomes the next Supreme Leader. Number of clerical associations and bodies in the Shrine City of Qom certainly would be part of it. So it would be a larger conversation. The third alternative is that this system cannot survive the current Supreme Leader, right? That whatever deficiencies Ali Khamenei has, he is the glue that holds the system together, and his absence, the system will fall into fracture, into factional fighting and so forth, and indeed the Islamic Republic may collapse altogether. before election of 2012, that was probably more of a possibility given how fractured and divided the elite was against itself and how disaffected the population was. So one of the clever things that Ali Khamenei has done is to try to put the elite back together. Hasn't succeeded with everybody, but has succeeded with some people. So as you can see, the succession to Ali Khamenei is likely to be a turbulent time in the Islamic Republic's history. It may be the last chapter in the Islamic Republic's history as well, but certainly it'll be difficult.
So there is no obvious, I believe they have to achieve a certain level of religious knowledge.
Well, actually, the Constitution of 1989 reduced the religious qualifications necessary for that office. They used to be has to be Grand Ayatollah and source of emulation, but given the lackluster religious credentials that Ali Khamenei had, in order to make him the supreme leader, they had to essentially change the constitutional provision and emphasize political service and essentially reduce the religious qualifications that is required for that. Because at that time, there were very few Grand Ayatollahs. Some of them were quite elderly, and others were not reliable revolutionaries. So therefore, revolutionary credentials were elevated as a basis of succession, and by necessity, the theological erudition was diminished. So, you know, they can go down to more middle ranks to succeed Ali Khamenei. They don't have to remain at high ranks. Some of the names that would be suggested would be a former head of the judiciary, Ayatollah Shahroudi. He's got some problems because the disputes that he's of Iraqi origin and so on. That would be one name. Potentially Ahmad Hamid Khatami, not the reformist one, another hardline who's currently Friday prayer leader. But, you know, different factions will have different clerical representation. Some of the more hardline element would probably want to have Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi in that role, who's reactionary to the point of non-return. But you see how all this is going to play out.
Yeah.
And the faction who that manages to wrestle control will likely determine who the next candidate for that office is. It's unlikely to be product of consensus as it was last time, and more a product of which faction emerges at the top.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Will McGarvey with Community Presbyterian Church. Mr.
Hello?
McGarvey, are you on the line? Thank you. Our next question comes from Saptal Singh with World Sikh Council.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. So one aspect is the approaches of the supreme spiritual authority and the political leader. On the other hand, what are the feelings and the leanings of the general citizenry in terms of whether they prefer a theocratic state or otherwise? Because the general citizens' wishes are not always the only factor that are reflected in the election.
I had a little trouble hearing this, so let me just repeat the question, and you can tell me if I'm wrong. You wanted to know what is the view of this general citizenry toward the regime. Does that sound right?
Yes, towards the regime as well as towards whether they would prefer a theocratic state or a more secularly leaning state.
Yeah, I think there is little doubt that if the Iranian people had a choice of their government, they would not have chosen the current one. The current regime is, in many ways, the current system of theocratic absolutism is a repressive, stagnant, unconvincing, and inefficient. It tends to be parochial. It tends to be sort of isolationist, inward-looking. While the Iranian public at large tends to be more secular than any place else in the Middle East, simply because they had to have endured a theocracy, tends to be more cosmopolitan, would like to be re-engaged in global affairs, less concerned about the plight of Palestinians, and often complain about the Palestinianization of their foreign policy, perhaps even less concerned about developments in the Arab world, which have been the focus of so much of the Islamic Republic's energies, you know, being entangled in southern Lebanon and so forth. So I think the gap between state and society is quite large in the case of Iran. And that's why, you know, it's difficult to see how this regime has a large support domestically, simply because of some critical ways it is at odds with its constituency. And it is also a regime which in some ways is incapable of co-opting its population or important sectors of that population the way, for instance, the Chinese can. You know, they don't, Chinese do it by economic dividends and sort of, you know, vulgar nationalism. They don't have a convincing ideology that can get people to buy into the system irrespective of its material shortcomings. So it's, and they might not even have a reliable repressive services. So it is a regime much more tenuous, in my view, than it is anticipated because of its inability to bridge the gap between a young population that wants accountability, emancipation, cultural engagement with the West, and a political leadership that is afraid of all those three things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Our next question comes from Wilma Garvey with Community Presbyterian Church.
Hi. I'm also with Unifist Council of Contra Costa County in the Bay Area. And one of the members of our interfaith community are the Baha'i community. And I was wondering if you would believe that there might be a distinction made between religious freedom for religious minorities such as the Baha'i or Mandeans or others, and the ban on higher education that the Baha'is are experiencing right now and the closing of their college.
Yes, I think we discussed this, the Baha'is have been a source of much opposition by the Shi clerical hierarchy for a long time. They tend to view them as essentially distorters of Islam and heretical. In the past, many members of the Baha'i faith have been executed, so it's gone beyond persecution and obviously denied, as you mentioned, educational and other social political rights. This has been one of the persistent problems of Iran, to be fair, not just the Islamic republics. The Shah had a cynical approach to Baha'is. Anytime he wanted to placate the clerical community, he would launch an anti-Baha'i campaign, even though, as I mentioned, many members of the Baha'i community did manage to essentially gain economic and even some degree of bureaucratic and political status during the time of the monarchy, probably because the monarchy was sensitive to Western criticisms of such primordial practices. But the Islamic Republic tends to deny human rights, that human rights campaigns and human rights injunctions and human rights norms as Western fabrications and ploys for regime change. So it is unlikely to be sympathetic to such petitions, particularly on this issue. I should say I think European Union has been more active on this front than the United States has, for that matter. And one of the problems with the nuclear issue is every time you mention other such things, they tend to be sidetracked because it is viewed that negotiating a nuclear arms control agreement with Iran is so important and so central that it shouldn't be encumbered with other competing mandates, such as the religious freedoms that you're talking about. That's one of the advantages of the nuclear stalemate for the Iranian regime, because it shields it from criticism on its behavior toward its own citizens, and not just in terms of religious freedom, but the entire spectrum of abuses that it inflicts on its citizens who don't buy into the practices of the Iranian regime. Yes.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Shaikh Ubad with Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you for taking my question. When we look at the scenario in Syria, Iran, which was at the pinnacle of popularity among even the Sunni Arabs, after having supported Tunisian, Libyan, Egyptian, and Yemeni freedom movements, sacrifice it all by supporting this tyrannical regime. So it looks like it was a very fanatical move, almost based on the belief in Sufyani and the coming of the last days. When the regime takes such a suicidal move geopolitically, is there anybody in their military establishment who points out the fallacy of such a move? Iran is now very isolated in the world because of what it has done in Syria.
I think that's one way of looking at it. I'm not sure if that particular perspective has much constituency within the regime, probably within the larger public that understands the kind of cost of the Syrian conflict. In terms that you suggested, the reputational terms, but also in terms of economic terms. Iran is a country in difficult economic strait, yet it is said to be contributing $500 million a month to the Syrian war effort at the time when that money could be spent on other things. From the Iranian perspective, from the regime's perspective, however, as I mentioned, Syria is an important front in a conflict that it is having in the region. And in that particular sense, Iran's support for Syrian regime and is quite viable within its own narrow constituencies. So the argument that you're suggesting, namely that Iran's participation in the Syrian conflict has estranged it from its large neighbors and has isolated it in an international community, is not one that I suspect is widely shared within corridors of power.
Let me be clear. I'm not talking about the government, but the Sunni masses. The whole Arab street was pro-Iranian.
Yes.
The new regime that would come in Syria would be a pro-Iranian regime dominated by Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, Iran would have still be in a winning position if it had supported the freedom struggle in Syria.
No, I think that's the entire Arab Spring has essentially caused some degree of estrangement of Iran from the Arab Sunni street, as you suggested. Part of the reason why Iran, President Ahmadinejad, has some degree of popularity was a protest against the incumbent regimes. Now you begin to see a new model of Arab political Islam emerging, which essentially Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and so on, which is more focused on sort of a changing internal arrangements of the Egyptian state socially and culturally, while the Iranian brand of political Islam has always been predicated on anti-Zionism and anti-imperialism. So there's already, for average Sunni street dweller, there are other sources of Islamic parties that he can appeal to, or in terms of allegiance, as opposed to the Islamic Republic. So just the emergence of the Arab Spring, I think, has caused some sort of a problem in terms of Iran's approach and popularity and soft power. But as you mentioned, being complicit in the Syrian conflict has further estranged it from critical sectors. No question about that. But, you know, Iran is now stuck where it is, with influence among some Shi'i enclaves. Some of those Shi'i enclaves are not inconsequential anymore. They have to be the state of Iraq, but far more limited in terms of its appeal than a more pan-Islamic appeal. It is now a sectarian appeal, and a sectarian appeal will likely have, as is obvious, would have a more diminished audience.
Ray, we're nearing the end of our time. I wanted to see if you could wrap up by giving us your thoughts on how you would advise the president on U.S.-Iranian relations and in the hopes of shaping in the next 5 years. I mean, what would you say should be the path that we should proceed along?
Well, I think there's a possibility of getting some sort of an agreement on some aspect of the nuclear program. That's not going to be simple. I don't think there's a whole deal on the nuclear program, but perhaps some of the more troublesome activities can be negotiated and restrained in a diplomatic context, and so that essentially buys some time. As mentioned before, I think we have to have a more active human rights policy, which I think is a useful complement to arms control. They're often thought of as distinct. Arms control has to be pursued without such entanglements because the regime in question becomes suspicious of your motives. I don't think that's right. I think if he had a more concerted human rights policy, perhaps we would have conditioned the Iranian elite into accepting the notion that being a global actor in good standing requires not just commitment to one's proliferation pledges, but also different treatment of one's citizens. So I think they can be a useful complement, and that's also missing from the American policy debate at this particular point. There has been so much written about what a nuclear deal looks like and what the physics of all this is. I'm not sure if I can add much to that, but I would say, you know, as was mentioned, the human rights policy can be a useful and important complement to the measures undertaken on the nuclear portfolio.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us today to share your insights, and to everybody on the call for your questions. I think it was a very productive hour. I hope you will all come to the website, cfr.org, to follow Ray's analysis and other scholars here, as well as to go to our religion portal at www.cfr.org/religion. Our next conference call will be on a week from today. It will address the Swiss government's attempts to engage Salafis in dialogue, and we will send out a detailed invitation. We are also excited to announce that we will be hosting a luncheon event on November 25th at the American Academy of Religion annual meeting in Baltimore. We'll be featuring CFR fellow Rachel Vogelstein on why it is morally and strategically imperative to end the practice of child marriage. So if you plan to be in Baltimore for AAR, or you have colleagues that you know will be there, please do let us know by emailing outreach@cfr.org. So again, Ray, Take, thank you very much for today.
Sure, thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.